So, welcome everybody. This is the fourth lecture in my course on the Arahant and the Four Truths in Early Buddhist Discourse. As usual, I first go through what we had in the blog. There was a longer discussion on the nature of dukkha, and there was a very pertinent comment made by Manfred Wiesberger. He says, the subject of dukkha is entirely subjective, and once it is taken that way, there can be no confusion. And then he plays a little bit with words. He says, I dukkha because I experience physical pain. I dukkha because something that seemed desirable is no longer desirable to me. I dukkha because I cannot get my five factors of existence to be as I want them to be. As for the Arahant, who dukkhas? I thought that was really nicely put with a little bit of wit, and it clarifies what we mean when we say that the Arahant has eradicated dukkha. Certainly, as even the Buddha experiences physical pain, I think I might have mentioned this in the first or the second lecture, that there are occasions where the discourses say the Buddha said he had back pain, and he asked another disciple, you teach in my place, I want to stretch out. So he fears that there is pain, and he also does the appropriate action required by the situation, but he doesn't suffer because of it. He is not mentally affected by it. Yeah, after this witty clarification, we can go straight away for the discourses. So the first discourse we looked at last time, Madhyama Agama 24, that was this lion's roar, this strong proclamation made by Sariputta, where he is being wrongly accused, and then he illustrates the way he reacts to this, his attitude, with various similes. And we had the simile of the ox who has his horns off, an outcast, then the four elements, a broom, and I think in the Chinese also a rag, and then the image of a jug with cracks where the oil comes out, and finally the very stark image of a pretty young girl or pretty young boy that find that somebody has hung a corpse around their neck. And at that time when I presented these similes, I already said that I have some doubts about the way this part of both discourses presents the attitude of an Arahant towards his or her body. So this is a topic that I want to explore now. First, some comments from the blog. This is Linda Grace. She says, in regard to the last two similes, the one on the jug and particularly the one with the corpse hung around the neck, in addition to the idea, that being filled with disgust for the body seems to imply aversion and not detachment and equanimity, and that these similes do not conclude with describing the mind dwelling in the Brahma-viharas, in the divine abidings, there is something else that I find quite odd, she says. That is, the similes used in numbers 3 to 8, these are the similes on the elements, the broom, the rag, specifically use the image of impure bodily excretion in describing how earth, water, fire, wind, broom, and rag deal with both what is pure and impure, without feeling embarrassed, ashamed, or humiliated. And Sariputta uses these similes to describe his own mind. But then in simile 10, when he describes contemplating the impure parts of his body, he says, "My mind is embarrassed and ashamed and filled with utter disgust." Nearly the exact opposite response that he has used in the previous similes in relation to impurities of the body seems not to fit very well. Yeah, I just really like to thank Linda for this really astute observation. It really hit me. Actually, I thought I should have seen that myself. Yeah, but it's really great observation, and that really inspired me to do a little bit more research on this particular passage. But before I present what I have found, I give a few more comments from the blog which are related to this and which I personally found helpful. And after that we have time to discuss. So Mark Johnson, he says, "I think introducing disgust as a form of aversion would be a mistake with someone who is able to see the body for what it is." Yeah, I think that's a good point. As long as this means to have aversion, then when somebody has a true vision of reality, we would not expect him or her to have such an attitude. There's a longer comment by Juliana Martini. She explains the whole idea of... She's actually written a nice paper on that. So she explains the whole idea of asubha, of this lack of beauty or impurity even. She says, "Asubha, or the contemplation of the absence of beauty, can lead to absorption because it practically facilitates detachment from the body." Excuse me. "And the necessary cooling down of the five external senses, necessary to enter the beginning or access stages of concentration as well as absorption. Thus it can bring about joy and lead to joy, one of the factors of jhana, quite different from disgust. Disgust, in fact, would be the result of incorrect practice. The heart of the matter is not disgust, which can perhaps be instrumental as an antidote to lust, but coming back to the middle ground, where liking and disliking do not push and pull, because there is mindfulness and right vision, seeing things simply as they are." She also says, "The texts speak of contemplating the impure, asuchi, parts of the body as a way of developing the perception of the non-beautiful. In ancient India, there's a strong cultural notion that the body is a source of impurity. This is primarily a ritual, but it spreads to all spheres of shared common knowledge. And henceforth, nobody would find it beautiful per se when reminded of its impurity. So the instructions somehow exploit this normal reaction, at least in the Indian context, in order to inject, so to speak, a response that will eventually help to rebalance and realign perceptions, to depotentize lust. Meditatively and cognitively in general, this works well because the ancient audience was already conditioned to recognize the impurity as non-beautiful." Yeah, I thought that was a very useful comment, especially reminding us of the Indian background. This notion of impurity in the practical courses on Satipatthana that I have taught is usually the one that most participants, particularly from a Western background, find really difficult. And I think the point that this should be seen against its Indian background is really helpful. And also that the discourses use this word impurity and the word non-beautiful, asubha, interchangeably, leaves it open to us to decide which of these two terms captures this particular attitude towards the body better. And in my personal experience, it's definitely asubha, the absence of beauty, that speaks to me much more than impurity. And then there is a last comment from Stuart Corner, very witty. I cracked up when I read that. He says, but from a human perspective, the body is disgusting, eh? If you leave it alone to go its own way for a few days, everyone holds their noses when you walk by. You need to be constantly on top of it to maintain even a little bit of beauty, and that is very wearisome work. So yeah, he has definitely a point in that. And I think there is definitely a point in seeing the parts usually of the body usually perceived as attractive in balance with those parts usually seen as repulsive. And to balance these out, it is good to see that there are disgusting parts of the body, and as Stuart has put in a way that I can't put it as nicely as him, but it's definitely a fact, yeah. If we don't keep on cleaning our body, it gets into a condition that is not very pleasant for ourselves and others. But still, I think the attitude of an arahant, and this is one of the two main topics of our course here, should, as far as I can see, be balanced. There's one comment here by Bruni Alessandra. Anyway, the body is impermanent, and its observation should bring to understand the real nature of the body. Yeah, that's quite true. That's the whole point. Now, I have been a little bit following up this particular statement that triggered off this very interesting discussion, and also very useful for me, because this is a topic I'm at present actually collecting information on, this whole idea of contemplating impurity or non-beautiful. And here I have the passages again, and I have been reminded, I think by Rodolfo, somebody on the blog mentioned that there's also an Ekotarika Agama parallel. Normally, in my presentation, I concentrate on the Madhyama Agama and the Pali parallel, but when these difficult passages come up, it is always important to look at all extant parallels in order to get a proper evaluation. And so, as you can see here on the board, we have all three versions have this simile of a pretty girl or boy or just a girl that has a corpse hung around her neck. And the Anguttara Nikaya has what is probably the strongest of the three statements. I'm repelled, horrified, and disgusted with this putrid body. And after that, I have also put the Pali. Imina puti kayena atanti yami harayami jiguttan chami. And the Madhyama Agama says, I constantly contemplate the foul and impure parts of this body. My mind is embarrassed, ashamed, and filled with utter disgust. And the Ekotarika Agama is relatively short. We get the simile, and the girl is detests having this corpse hung around her neck, and then Sariputta says, I'm like this, I detest this body, just like that, not different. The word for detest, the Chinese character, can have a variety of meanings and can also stand for what in Pali is sangvega, which is not really disgust, but more in the direction of disenchantment. But I think in view of the simile, the idea of somebody who's just dressed up, made herself very beautiful, and then you put a corpse around her neck. This is certainly detesting or disgusting. This is not just disenchantment. So we have this statement in all of the three versions, although we can see like an increase. It seems that the Pali version is making a very strong statement, and the Ekotarika is the weakest one. He just says he detests this body. Yeah, and so then I started to do some search based on the Pali. But the Chinese character of detest, wait, I have it here, I think. Doopy doopy doop. There it is. I just pasted it in for you. And Hiragava, the Chinese Sanskrit dictionary, gives Nirveda, Sangvega, Udvigna, and Jagupsnaya for Sanskrit counterparts. Yeah, so with the Chinese Agamas, the problem is that they are all by different translators. So, for example, the term I just pasted in for Wei Yin Chou, it might be this term in the Ekotarika Agama, but the same Indic original may be translated by a different term in the Madhyama Agama or Samyukta Agama and so on. Therefore, it is much more difficult to search, but in the Pali version, we don't have that problem. So what I did is I searched for this Atiyami, Harayami, Jikuchami, this series of being repelled, horrified, and disgusted in different grammatical forms. And I also searched for the Putikaya, the putrid body. Before I get into those passages, there's one which is not related to the body, but which I think still connects very nicely with what Manfred has told us about dukkha. And this is in the Itivuttaka. I'm just pasting in the references if any of you wants to follow these up. Mark asks to make the characters bigger. No, I can't make them bigger, but I mean, Wei Yin Chou has understood and I can't make them bigger. Anyway, I don't want to go too much into this small philological things. I want to stay with the main topics. So, Itivuttaka 43, this is the page of the PTS edition, and this describes those who lag behind, those who go too far, and those who hit the middle way approach. So those who lag behind are those who are in love with existence, but those who go too far are those who are repelled, horrified, and disgusted by bhava, by existence. I just read the Pali for those of you who Bhavineva Kopane Atiyamana Harayamana Jikuchamana Vibhavang Abhinandanti. They delight in non existence because they are repelled, horrified, and disgusted with existence. And those who have true vision, who see things as just see things as they are, and are disenchanted, are detached. This already gives us a little bit of a feeling that this series of terms, horrified, repelled, horrified, and disgusted, is very strong. Now, the full set of terms, that is to say, this putrid body, and I'm repelled, horrified, and disgusted with it, occurs also in the Samyutta Nikaya 131. This is Bhikkhuni Vijaya, and she is being challenged by Mara, who is trying to challenge her, inviting her to indulge in sensuality, I believe, or something of that type. So it's a situation we get repeatedly where Mara approaches nuns who are meditating all alone, and these nuns have to defend themselves against this male aggressor. So in this situation, she clarifies that she is repelled, horrified, and disgusted with this putrid body. While the context makes such a statement somewhat understandable, it is remarkable that both of the parallels that we have in the Samyukta Agama Taisho 99 and in the Parsha Samyukta Agama Taisho 100 do not have such a statement. There's no statement at all by Vijaya saying, I'm disgusted by my body in any way. Then we get a similar passage in the Tirigata. This is the collection of verses by awakened nuns, Bhikkhuni Khema, and she's in a similar situation. She is trying to defend herself against Mara, who is more or less inviting her to sensual pleasures or sex. And she's using the same passage that to explain to him she's not interested in sex. Or in sensual pleasures, she says, I'm repelled, horrified, and disgusted with this putrid body. The Teddy Gata, unfortunately, we do not have a parallel. It seems that only in the Theravada tradition has this collection by awakened nuns been transmitted. We have references to it in the Mula Sarvastivada Vinaya, also in the Samyukta Agama, but we do not have the collection itself. At some point in the history of transmission of the text in India, this was apparently lost. Yeah, and then there is another passage. This is in the Samyutta Nikaya, excuse me, volume 320. This is the story of Vakkali. Vakkali is sick and asks the Buddha to come, and the Buddha comes and says, how is your condition and do you have any regrets? And the Vakkali says, yes, I haven't been able to see you for so long. And then the Buddha says to him, what's the use of seeing this putrid body of mine? So we don't have the passage on being repelled, horrified and disgusted, but the Buddha speaks of his own body as imina putikayena, again the instrumental, this putrid body of mine. Again, we have two Chinese Agama parallels. Both of them do not have any such expression, but I need to mention that the whole interchange moves differently in these agamas. The story of Vakkali wanting to see the Buddha is not there in the first place. Before I continue, I have a look here. John Emmer says, these are reminiscent of Hypatia rejecting a suitor by giving him her menstrual cloth to illustrate the nature of the body after which he lusts. Yeah, I don't know this story. But it has a very similar ring. Thank you for putting it in. I assume from the name it may be something Greek. Yeah, Greek philosopher, right. Lovely. Oh, thank you very much, John. Yeah, it's the same point to try to bring out the repulsive nature of their own body in order to stop the male aggressor. Now, the entire passage, I'm repelled, horrified, and disgusted with this putrid body, comes again in the Samyutta Nikaya with the parallel in the Vinaya. And this is the story of the mass suicide of monks. It's a very tough story. This is in fact what I'm at present collecting information, and I will be writing a paper on that. So the story is there's a apparently recently ordained monks, and the Buddha gives them a recommendation. He praises the practice of asubha, of contemplating the non-beautiful or even impure nature of the body. And in the Pali version, the Buddha then goes on a meditation retreat, but in all of the parallels I have checked, this meditation retreat is not mentioned. Anyway, the Buddha is not present, and these monks start practicing in such an unbalanced manner that they imina kayena atiyamana harayamana jiguchamana sattaharakang pariyesanti. Being repelled, horrified and disgusted with their body, they search for a knife. They want to kill themselves. They want to commit suicide. And there's then a story that somebody helps them, those who are not able to do it themselves, and at the next Parimokkha recitation, or in the Pali version, at the time when the Buddha comes out of his retreat, he says, oh, Ananda, how come so few monks? And Ananda says, Bhante, yeah, you know, you gave this recommendation on asubha, and you know what happened. And the Buddha calls the monks together and says, monks, there's a very peaceful way of meditation, mindfulness of breathing. Yeah, this story is a tricky one. For our understanding, I think an important point is that the Buddha has not given full instructions there. He is just, and this is in all the versions, the different Vinayas that I checked, he's just praised asubha. So my own my own take on this story is that it shows us how contemplating the absence of beauty or impure nature of the body, if it is not done properly according to the instructions, can go totally overboard. The instructions we find in the Satipatthana Sutta give us, for example, this simile. They say it's just as looking at it seems to be a sawing utensil, a bag, ubuta muka mutoli, a bag with two openings that is full of grains and rice. So if you look at rice and mung beans and things, I mean, you don't feel their beauty, you don't feel disgusted, it's just a very balanced, you see, oh, there's rice, there's mung beans, etc. This is the appropriate attitude when contemplating the anatomical nature of the body. And so my own take on the suicide story is that because these were new monks, because the Buddha had not given full instructions on how to undertake this meditation, but had just recommended it, these monks started to practice on their own, and they still had this ancient Indian background, which Juliana has described to us. And so the practice went overboard, and nobody was apparently present with the type of authority to say, stop, no, this is not the way you should do it. But coming back to our actual topic, because there was some discussion on the blog whether disgust towards the body is involved with aversion or not, the precisely same passage, the same words, just in the plural, that the Anguttara Nikaya, according to the Anguttara Nikaya, Sariputta says about his own body is precisely what describes the mental condition of these unawakened monks who are just about to commit suicide. And there's another two passages where the same is again used in relation to suicide. This time it's not a report of actual suicide. It's a story of Venerable Punna not Mantaniputta, the other Punna. And he, there's a series of things that might happen to him. And every time he says, well, if somebody abuses me, I think I'm fortunate that they don't hit me. And then the Buddha says, so if somebody hits you, well, I'm glad that at least they don't use a knife to stab me. And if somebody stabs you, well, I'm glad that at least they don't kill you. And the Buddha says, if somebody kills you, well, in that case, I reflect there are other disciples of the Buddha who, being repelled, horrified, and disgusted with this putrid body, kill themselves. No, it's not putrid body. It's just kaya cha jivita, I'm sorry. Being repelled, horrified, and disgusted with their body and life. So, rounding up this discussion, we are in a very, for me, very puzzling situation. There is very good arguments, particularly the argument made by Linda, and also the passages I presented now, which seem to indicate that speaking of this putrid body is understandable, but being repelled, horrified, and disgusted by it does not seem to be the type of attitude we would associate with an arahant. At the same time, we have three parallel versions who, even though in less stronger terms in the Chinese Agamas, agree that the Buddha, the Sariputta, made such a statement. If you have any questions or comments now or on the blog. Yeah, then I continue. The other discourse that we had a look at last time, that was Madhyama Agama 25. And that was a discourse that... Oh, there are some questions. Well, I continue for a little while, and when you have done your questions, I come back to you. There was a discourse on five cases where one might feel resentment towards another person and how one can change one's perception of this other person, because that is the thing that triggers our resentment, and that make, if we change the way we see the other person, we will also be better able to deal with the state in our own mind. And just to remind us again of the different things that we had. So the first was, if somebody has bodily impurity, then this is like a dirty cloth. We just take the parts that are clean. If somebody has verbal impurities, it's like plants on the water surface. We push them aside to get into the water. If somebody has body and verbal impurity, this is like the water in the hoof of an ox. We kneel down to take whatever little we can get from it. If somebody is totally impure, this is like a sick person all alone in the wilderness, the ideal occasion for being compassionate. And if somebody has no impurities, then this is like a beautiful pool. Enjoy it. There are some comments on this, but I want to first see what's happening in the chat. Mark says, since the Chinese versions are softer in the approach, could it be that in the act of translation, the translation was softened for the benefit of the Chinese audience? That is an interesting idea, Mark, but particularly Ekotarika Agma can be very, very tough. And usually it has the more stronger expressions. So the Ekotarika Agma is a problematic collection. But my personal impression would be that the way the Chinese has come down probably represents what was there in the Indic original. But a good idea. Rodolfo, shouldn't it be equanimity and not disgust towards the body? Disgust does not sound like the middle path. Yeah, Rodolfo, that's precisely my feeling. That is precisely why I said already last time I have a problem with these passages. But I also try to explain the methodological approach, that when there are parallel versions who say the same, then on the methodological position, I can say I find this difficult, I can say this does not fit with what I see in other passages, but I cannot just reject it and create my own story. So this is, for me, a very, very interesting case we have here. Mark says, I think within Chinese culture, the extreme of disgust with the body would not work very well. Mark, I'm not sure about that. You see, even if you think of all this self-cremation in the history of Chinese Buddhism, which actually started with pre-Buddhist practices in China, I'm not sure. It's a good idea, but I mean, I can't prove, I don't have the Indic originals, but my personal feeling would rather be that we have, in these three passages I am showing on the board, we have three levels, three stages of development, and that the Anguttara Nikaya is perhaps the most developed one. Yeah, I think now I go for the next block things, and then I catch up on the questions that are there. So we are back to our five ways of feeling, getting out of a feeling of resentment. And Robert Grosch says, and I thought that was very nice, I interpret the progression in points 1 through 3, that is when somebody has only verbal impurity or only mental impurity. From bodily to both bodily and verbal impurity is intended to urge us to look very carefully, maybe even on ever finer levels, for what is good in another when we feel resentment towards that person. I thought that was a very, very good point, this kind of need to this. I think this is the real dynamic in this discourse, this need to look closer, not to be easily satisfied with our assessment of this person is bad and he's wrong and I don't like him, but make a real effort, as Robert says, to look very carefully. Isn't there something good in him or her, at least on a subtle level? And then he also says, the first three points are actually very hard training. To help us if we are overwhelmed, he offers option 4, which stops the analysis and only focuses on metta. Yeah, I thought it was also very, I could relate to that comment immediately from my own practice, because sometimes this trying to go to the final level and see something good, it feels a little strenuous. You feel like, well, there should be something good in him, shouldn't there? And so at that point, it's really like, okay, I'm overdoing it, and it's just the time to sit down. And if he is totally impure or not, this is the time for metta or compassion. I know, before I continue with the blog comments, I see what's happening in the chat. Stewart Corner. If you see the body as, I'm sorry, the first was Rodolfo, no? Disgust may have been a prescriptive method against lust. Yeah, definitely. There's a series of perceptual trainings in the early discourses, Pali Nikayas and Chinese Agamas. The Pali terms are particular, aparticular sanyi, and aparticular, particular sanyi. The perception of what is repulsive in that which is generally seen as unrepulsive, and the opposite. So the perception of repulsiveness, the disgust, does have a function. There is no question. And Stuart Corner had so nicely told us about the body's true nature. But the point is, this is an intermediate stage in the meditative training. I would not expect the Arahant to have any more need of that. That is the point that puzzles me. Stuart Corner, excuse me. If you see the body as a sign of existence, then repulsion seems appropriate for an Arahant as an example for the rest of us. Yeah, Stuart, I fully agree with what you said on the blog about the body being not particularly attractive, but I thought I had brought up this quote before from the Itivuttaka, if I remember correctly, where I was saying, where the Pali says that those who have feel repulsion towards existence are those who go too far. There's a disinterest in existence. There's a disenchantment with it. But there's a, I think the question is, maybe it's a question of terminology. But I find this Itivuttaka discourse makes it very clear. The question is not to say, ah, life is so wonderful. The question is also not to say, ah, I can't stand it anymore. It's horrible. But I rather think that the question is a disenchantment. Venerable Sukhachitu, if you want to say something, we have to use the chat. This microphone function is not working. So I click off this raising of the hand. Yeah, then there was a comment by Bruni, Alessandra. Discuss its function to the right view. Everything is useful to show the non-existence of the aggregates. I always remember that Buddha didn't reach the illumination for human beings, but only after having seen their misery, he began to preach his doctrine. Yeah, fully with you. Oh, I don't know how to pronounce your name now. Forgive me if I'm doing it wrong. Le Chang Le. Can we practice metta, asubha and metta at the same time? Well, not exactly at the same time, but I can say from my own practice that I practice one right after the other. That is actually my own meditation practice. The first thing I do every day in the morning is asubha practice. And the joy I get from that is perfect for getting into metta. And the two really build on each other, because the asubha has also cleared out any tendency towards even minimal sensuality. And it's a perfect foundation. And I personally think that this progression actually underlies something we call the eight vimokkhas, the eight liberations. But this will take us off too far from the main topic, I think. But my understanding that the first is seeing forms internally, the other next is seeing forms externally, and the third is being determined on what is beautiful. And seeing forms internally and externally in some traditions is understood as contemplating asubha, as practicing contemplation on the anatomical part. And being determined on what is beauty is actually metta meditation. And we will come to metta meditation either today or in the next session. metta meditation is the supreme of beauty. Metta meditation is practiced with a mind of purity. When it is such practiced, it consists what early Buddhism does recognize as recommendable form of beauty. So the idea of bodily beauty is being replaced by the conception of mental beauty. That is why asubha and metta stand in a very close connection. Thank you for the question. Yeah, so let me see where I was. Yeah, I brought in the comment by Robert Grosch. No, that was Rosa Grau. She was making a comment in regard to point 3 about about getting rid of resentment. This is the case where somebody is impure bodily and verbally, but not mentally. And she comments in regard to the Pali version, being able to obtain mental calmness or not cannot be checked in another, only in oneself, unless you ask the other person. That is, she says, how can this work that I know somebody else is impure bodily, is impure verbally, but is not impure, is pure on the mental level? And I thought that was a very good point to get a better handle on this description here. So the exact phrasing in the Madhyama Agama that we get, she was referring to the Pali version, but in the Madhyama Agama it says, there is someone whose bodily and verbal actions are impure, but whose mind is pure to a small extent. Now the Pali version, forgive me for the Pali, Labati ca kalena kalang cetaso vivaram cetaso pasadam. So this person gains from time to time vivara of the mind. Vivara is an opening of the mind. And pasada of the mind. This pasada is brightness or purity. So I would understand this not to mean that this person has he has gotten third jhana and he has gotten second jhana. Because actually that would also not be possible. Somebody who is impure in bodily and verbal action, how could they have deep samadhi attainments? But just we see that from time to time there's some degree of mental clarity in this person, some degree of openness of the mind. And I think this relates back to the very helpful explanation we got from Robert of this looking very carefully. We see a person is acting in a wrong manner or in an unwholesome manner. He or she is speaking in a wrong or unwholesome manner. There is still a chance for us to discover that this is not like this 24 hours a day, 31 days a month. There might be just small little moments where we see this person is a little bit open. There is a little bit of something positive. Even it does not transmit into full-fledged bodily or verbal actions. But we can see it somewhere in the way he or she reacts in a certain situation or is suddenly willing to listen to someone else just even for a moment or whatever. So I would understand it in this way. Yeah, and then there was another comment by Mark. Now we come to the fifth simile. And the simile of bathing in a beautiful pond, which illustrates having no resentment towards someone who is completely pure. And Mark says, excuse me, two of the similes used by Venerable Sariputta indicate the enjoyment and appreciation of nature. He enjoys a pleasant bath and rids himself of the oppression by heat, hunger, thirst, exhaustion. And not far from a village, there's a pool full to the brim with clear, beautiful water, its banks covered with verdant grass and surrounded by flowering trees. I would think, in the monk's simple life, unattached to sensual pleasures, such basic things as being able to bathe in a lovely setting with flowering trees and all would be most welcome. Yeah, I'm not totally unattached to sensual pleasures, but I certainly think that's right. Yeah. When you live out I'm not doing that, but in the early times of my monkhood, I was living on a mountain in a cave and just without anything, just going begging in the morning for food, and these little beauties of nature. For me, it is particularly like little animals, the way they... It's so beautiful. And this is a type of joy that you get, which I put my feet firmly on the ground and say, this is not unwholesome. It was something that was inspiring my practice and helping me onwards. And then last comment by Linda Grace, and then we are ready with the blog discussion. She says about the last case, the person that is entirely pure and like a beautiful pond, she says that this could also to be a lovely way of describing mudita, appreciative joy. If resentment, that perhaps could also be envy, arises in relationship to someone who has such pure qualities, actually focusing on the wholesome body, speech and mental actions of that person is enormously refreshing. That purity is something to rejoice in and can be a support for purification of one's own mind. That is quite true. Yeah, so this is the, again, very lively discussion we had on the blog. These are the few comments. I can't present everything to you, so I can only recommend you all go and look there yourself on the discussion that we had. And now I am kind of ready to get into Madhyamagama 26, but there's no time for any other questions that you might have. Let me just check I didn't miss out any questions. Yeah, I think I got all of you. Good, then we are ready to go into Madhyamagama 26. We are perfectly in time. This is a discourse. It has another discourse by our Arahant Sariputta. It takes up the topic of the forest monk. Yeah, this discourse, and later it also speaks about the city monk. This shows that at the time of the coming into being of this discourse, these two prototypes of Buddhist monastics were to some degree already in existence. The forest monk usually symbolizes a more stronger dedication to the practice, to meditation practice, living in the forest, ideally following some of the ascetic practices and living on begging. And the city monk usually stands more for living in closer association with the laity and looking after their ritual and other needs, and also more for the for the engagement in study. But these are obviously not clear-cut divisions. There are very learned forest monks. There are, I know myself, city monks who have quite profound meditation. But still we have these two prototypes, these two ideals. And usually one finds that monastics like to associate with one or the other of these two. And in modern days, we have this image of the forest monk will be the one who does not use money, maybe takes only one meal, and who has more concern about aspects of conduct, even in a Western setting, that are not so easily palatable to the Western audience. And so when you invite a West forest monk, you have to be very careful that you make sure that his vinaya needs are properly looked after. And the city monk is more the one who has a closer contact with the laity, those who are sometimes less concerned with minor aspects of conduct. They will use money and they will drive cars maybe. And yeah, So anyway, this is just a little bit of a background. Now, the actual setting of this discourse is that we have one of these forest monks, and his name is Gulisani. Excuse me. And he has come to visit the monastic community. And our friend Gulisani is not a particularly well-behaved monk. And so Sariputta takes up the opportunity for giving him a teaching, but he does this in a very, very beautiful and diplomatic way. He does not say, "Hey, Gulisani, what are you doing? This is not wrong, this is wrong, this is right." Instead, he notices Gulisani is around, and then he gives a general teaching. He says, "You see, if there's a forest monk, he should be like this and like that. I have myself experienced as a monk friend of mine who teaches in this way, and he has pointed out some of my mistakes in this manner. Just sitting in a circle with a few monks, and he was just saying, yeah, you see, if a monk does like this, then other monks feel like that." And it was such a beautiful experience because I was able to fully take in what he was saying without in the least feeling my ego getting hurt. If he would have said, even us being alone, leave alone others around, "Analeo, you did this and that was not nice and you shouldn't do," that would have been a completely different picture. So one point that I think we can appreciate from this discourse is how skillful an arahant can express criticism. The discourses were showing us how an arahant reacts to criticism, to false accusation, and Sariputta has been teaching us five ways of dealing with resentment. And now, by example, he is showing how one can express criticism, which is necessary. You have to tell people. At that time, I needed to be told by another monk. These were just small things, but I still needed to be told. That was not the way I should be doing it. But this other monk was doing it in such a nice way, I'll never forget that. It's a very beautiful experience. I wish I could do it like that. Yeah, so now time for me to read the sutta for you. Venerable friends, a forest-dwelling monk, when practicing forest-dwelling, should train in being respectful and compliant. Venerable friends, if a forest-dwelling monk, though practicing forest-dwelling, is often disrespectful and not compliant, he will incur other monks' disapproval and criticism. As for this venerable forest-dweller, for the sake of what does he practice forest-dwelling? Why do we say this? This venerable forest dweller, even though he practicing forest dwelling, is often disrespectful and not compliant. When he comes to stay amidst the monastic community, he will incur such disapproval and criticism from the other monks. Therefore, venerable friends, a forest dwelling monk, when practicing forest dwelling, should train in being respectful and compliant. So this same basic pattern of pointing out possible shortcomings and the way this will be perceived by others will then continue for several other qualities. But before that, I just wanted to mention that this idea, what do others think of me, is a much more important component in an Asian and in a monastic setting than maybe in average Western life. This is actually a way of teaching. If you live in a monastery, the way others teach you is, at least in Sri Lanka, is very much non-verbal. It's just you do something and then you feel afterwards somehow something was not quite right. And from there you realize yourself, if you are sensible enough, the next time you do it differently and you feel, no, there's no reaction by the others. It's really a kind of energy work almost. It requires a lot of mindfulness and a lot of metta also. And it's a very interesting way of teaching. It's quite different from what we have, and many young monks, I experienced that myself, they come and they say, "Look, I don't know, nobody's telling me what I should do, and why are they not pointing out?" The thing is that way of teaching works differently. And it also has to do with this Asian conception where one sees oneself more as part of a group, whereas in the West we are very much individuals. And so if you say, what? They're criticizing, so their problem? No. That is not at all the point. Anyhow, after this little explanation, now we have a look at all the qualities that are being taken up in the same manner. So besides, what was the first again? Let me see. he should be respectful and compliant. So he should, I read this now for you again. Stuart says, Bhante, it sounds like dog training. Yeah, I don't know about dog training, Stuart, but if that's the way... Yeah, obviously, you can't talk to them, no? Using energy, no words, yeah. That's actually a very nice example. Thank you, Stuart. Yeah, Stuart has this very, very nice examples he comes up with. Yeah, I just wanted to share my own experience there, and that I found this a very beautiful way of learning, even though I am myself not very good at teaching in that way. I am too blunt. Yeah, but it's like dog training. Yeah, with the dog you have to work on this energy level. I mean, you can still shout at it. It can hear from the voice, the sound of the voice, that whether you're angry or not, but it won't understand the words. Yeah. Good. Now I get into the qualities. So he should, our forest monk should train in refraining from making frivolous jokes and from behaving in a restless and agitated manner. I'm sorry. He should train in refraining from irrelevant talk, train in not bragging about himself and not being chatty. He should train in guarding the sense faculties. He should train in moderation in eating. He should train in being energetic and free from laziness. He should train in right mindfulness and right attentiveness. He should train in knowing the proper time and being skillful in regard to time. For example, not going into the village to beg for food too early and not returning too late. He should train in knowing proper seats and being skillful in choosing a seat. Not taking the seat of a senior monk or scolding junior monks for taking the seat that he wants. He should train in explaining and discussing the Vinaya and the higher Dharma. Why? Venerable friends, forest-dwelling monks, when practicing forest-dwelling, may encounter people who come with questions regarding the code of discipline and the advanced teachings. And he should train in explaining and discussing the peaceful liberations, the attaining of those formless concentrations that transcend form. Why? Venerable friends, a forest-dwelling monk, when practicing forest-dwelling, may encounter people who come with questions regarding the peaceful liberations, the attaining of those formless concentrations that transcend form. Excuse me. And he should train in explaining and discussing the higher knowledge of the destruction of the influxes. Why? Venerable friends, a forest-dwelling monk, when practicing forest-dwelling, may encounter people who come with questions regarding the higher knowledge of the destruction of the influxes. So after we get this whole series of behaviors, qualities, entertainments, Venerable Mahamoggallana is there and he says, Venerable Sariputta, should only forest-dwelling monks, when practicing forest-dwelling, train in these things, and not monks who stay among people? Venerable Sariputta replied, Venerable Mahamoggallana, forest-dwelling monks, when practicing forest-dwelling, should train in these things. How much more so monks who stay among people? And then we get a final stanza. This stanza is not found in the Pali. Be respectful, refrain from frivolous jokes. Do not engage in irrelevant talk and bragging. Guard the sense faculties, be moderate in eating, be energetic and have right mindfulness and attentiveness. Know the time and know proper seating. Discuss the code of discipline and the advanced teachings. Explain the peaceful liberations and the higher knowledge of the destruction of the influxes or taints, the asavas. Yeah, so we have this 13 qualities in the Madhyama Agama version, the higher dharma is a Chinese rendering of the Indic term abhidharma or abhidhamma, which we find occurs on several occasions in the earlier suttas, but which does not yet stand for the type of thought that is now found in the third of the three baskets. Yeah, the immaterial attainments, the peaceful liberations, the arupas, I think that is clear. Yeah. Then here we get the... It's too bad I can't make this bigger. Maybe I make it a little smaller, then it's easier to see. No, still... Well, we got 17 qualities in the Majjhima Nikaya. So we just have a look at them. I think I make it bigger again, then you can read easily. I anyway can't get it all to fit in the picture. So being respectful, this is quality number 1 in the Madhyama Agama. Then propriety with seats is number 10. You see again these variations in sequence that those of you who have been with me last year, we encounter ever so often in oral transmission. The actual qualities are being remembered fairly well, but the sequence in which they come, unless these are really fixed categories of doctrinal teachings, the sequence just varies. The next is about going to the village and not paying visits. This has no parallel in the Madhyama Agama. Then we come number 5, not being arrogant. Number 6, no loose talk. Then number 7, again, this has no real counterpart in the Madhyama Agama, easily being spoken to and cultivating good friends. Then again, we get restraint of the senses and moderate with food. These also are found in the Madhyama Agama. Wakefulness, number 10 in the Pali, no parallel. Being energetic and mindful, number 7 and 8 in the Madhyama Agama. Concentrated and wise, again, not in the Madhyama Agama. And then we get the same, here it's actually the higher dharma and higher vinaya, so abhidhamma abhivinaya. Again, the immaterial attainments, and then superhuman states, that is a more general term, which includes the destruction of the influxes, the 6 supernormal knowledges, I think, would be that. It's a little more broad. And the distinction here is that while in the Madhyama Agama, our friend only needs to be able to discuss these, here, he should actually be practicing them. The Pali is yoga karaniyo. He should apply himself to these. So overall, we get a stronger flavor of mindful meditation practice here, you see. We have, if we look back at the qualities, wakefulness, concentration, and wise. I mean, concentrated and wise would be included in the fact that somebody applies himself to immaterial attainments and to superhuman states, but not necessarily in the Madhyama Agama, because there is only to be able to discuss these. Although we would think in the ancient setting, for somebody to discuss these things, they would have to have some practical experience. We are not yet at the time when these things are being discussed by scholars who have never ever sat on a meditation cushion. So the qualities overall are similar. We see a gradual progression. We see the Pali version gives us a slightly stronger flavor of meditation practice than the Madhyama Agama. Yeah, so there were some. John Emmer, he says, it seems the first 7 qualities in the Madhyama Agama are about the forest monk when visiting the Sangha and the rest apply when he is on his own. Is there a similar division in the Majjhima Nikaya? That's a good point. I hadn't noticed that. See, these courses are wonderful. I learned so much from you. Yeah, good point. You see, in the Pali version, there is this thing about being questioned, but we are not being told explicitly that this happens when he is in the forest. Very keen observation, John. Thank you very much. When practicing forest dwelling, yeah. I would now offhand interpret this to mean that when our forest dwelling monk visits the community, he knows he's in danger of being questioned. But perhaps, I mean, this is just my offhand take on this observation, which I had not noticed before, is that even when he's alone in the forest, there are sometimes visitors who come. And this is actually quite true. Those who go all the way into the forest to visit a forest monk are those who are interested in the practice. They will not come there to discuss politics with him. They will come there for Advaita. This type of how do you get into jhana? How does one get stream-ready? They will ask this type of questions. So this is the way I would take it, that the Madhyama Agama does not mean to say that the ability to discuss, I just call it briefly samatha and vipassana to make it easy, is going to be of relevance only when he is in the forest, but that it can also be relevant when he is in the forest, not only when he exposes himself to the situation of being in a city, in a monastery. But in the Pali version we do not get this qualification. It just says that he should yoga karaniyo, because there are those who ask him questions about these things. Excellent observation, John. So, Wayne Cho, sounds like list for disciple in higher training. I think you are right for the second part. Yeah, I think we are moving towards this disciple in higher training. But the early early qualities, be respectful and not joking and not talking rubbish, not being arrogant, these are relevant to all of us, not those who have entered on the higher training. And those who are fairly advanced in the higher training, they might even naturally not need that type of admonishment. Let me just see where the Pali starts. Propriety, also being arrogant and loose talk. But it's a good point, definitely the later part is gives us this feeling that the graduate path is progressing from the average level of the practitioner towards the disciple in higher training. Mark S. Johnson. In the Madhyama Agama, the numbers 2 to 6 are about a monk coming out of the forest having experienced deprivation there and is overindulging when back among the monks and interacting with villagers. That's a good point, Mark. You see, again, something I learned today. Wow, you're wonderful. Lovely. Yeah, I'm sitting pretending to be the teacher and I'm just a student. Great. Yeah, quite true, actually. That's quite true. Because this is something we can often see with people who go for intensive meditation. When they come out, there's such an overreaction. They have to talk and get into doing, and there's a kind of a lack of balance there. And this is precisely the challenge. This is always the challenge point when we... I mean, I love going for retreats, and I recommend everybody to do long and much retreats. But the challenge is always when you come out. How are you able to balance the situation now? And this is, I think, if I understand Mark correctly, this is what you're pointing at. Where do I have them here? Yeah, this is precisely. You get agitated, you talk about rubbish, you become chatty and arrogant, your senses are not restrained, and you fill yourself up with food. Excellent. Excellent. Wayne Cho is just saying right speech, ? Yeah, I'm not sure I understand that comment, Wayne Cho. The issue of speech is being brought up with not talking about irrelevant things, which is one of the four forms of inappropriate speech. The others are not directly taken up. John Emmer, I actually had my observations labeled backwards. It was the Majjhima Nikaya that said, when the forest dweller comes to the Sangha for the first seven and not the rest, and I didn't know about the Madhyama Agama. Yeah, John, but that doesn't matter. I mean, we got it clarified, and the situation is very clear, and that was a very keen observation. Very good. Very helpful to get a clearer sense of that discourse. Yeah, I'm still with this 2 to 6 and the issue of coming from the forest and then overindulging in the things of the world. Yeah, do I have time for a little story? I think I give a little story. Yeah, I did a very long retreat. It was, I think, a 1 month retreat in the desert in India. And I was just completely, there was nothing. I mean, it's just everything is this beige color from the sand. And the only color you could see were the peacocks that were coming in the early morning and sitting on top of the meditation hall and spreading their feathers. Everything else was just beige. And the food was very simple. Just this rice and chapatis and dal. And because at that place I couldn't stay longer, so as soon as the retreat finished, I had to go back to Sri Lanka. And the flight, the Sri Lankan airline flight, there was a strike by the pilots. And so when I came to the airport, I was told the flight is cancelled and we put you into a 5-star hotel. And so I had to spend the night in this 5-star hotel with all these colors and people and things. And then the next morning there was this buffet and somebody was kind enough to offer me the food. And it was just like, I mean, you're in India, but that was like 5 different types of muesli, 7 different types of German bread, and there was just everything in the world that you could think of. And I have to admit that while sitting those 30 days in the desert, I had some time to time not been doing my meditation properly, but I've been thinking, wouldn't it be nice to have a little bit of muesli now? German bread with a little bit of cheese? And yeah, after that buffet, I had stomach cramps for the rest of my journey. And from that experience onwards, I have no longer had problems doing meditation retreats with thinking about food. Sorry for this little story, but Mark's comment has just really hit me. And so actually... It makes so much sense. Yeah, enough about this analayo and now. Thanks, Mark. I'm sometimes a little bit worried. I'm talking too much foolish stories about myself, and I should be sticking to the discourse and be a serious monk and university professor, but sometimes I just can't help. Okay. The main points that we get out of this description, as I said before, is this concern for others. This is, first of all, clear in the way Sariputta gives this teaching, and also in these qualities, that proper behavior towards others is really an integral part of the training. And I wanted to bring up another discourse that illustrates that. You excuse me for a second. The Mahagopalaka Sutta, and I've done a study of that discourse, and you find the PDF of the article on the OLAT page where the lectures are, and you are free to download it. There's no copyright restriction on this PDF. And so this discourse on the cowherd, I find this fits in very nicely with our topic of the Arahant and this idea that I want to flesh out, that the Arahant in early Buddhism is not an egoist. Definitely not. And this idea that the Arahant is selfish and not concerned about others is simply, this is a rhetoric that arose at a very later stage in the history of Buddhist thought with its reasons and conditions, but this is not what we get in the early suttas. And so in the Mahagopalaka Sutta, we get this description of the illustration of a cowherd. A cowherd has to have certain qualities. He has to look after the cows in a certain way so that he does his job properly. And similarly, there are these qualities that a monk should have. Again, this doesn't fit. Oh, no, I'm getting it. Okay. And so we have 11 qualities. He should have insight into the four elements, his body made up of earth, water, fire, and wind. He should know the difference between fool and wise, foolishness and wisdom. He should remove unwholesome states, and he should restrain the senses. Number 5, he should teach Dharma to others. Number 6, he should also question others about the Dharma. And number 7, he should be inspired by the Dharma. Number 8, he should know the Eightfold Path. Number 9, he should know the four Satipatthanas, the four establishment of mindfulness. Number 10, he should be moderate with requisites. And number 11, he should be having metta or respect towards elders. The same obviously applies for nuns. Yeah, I just like to note that in this set of qualities, we very clearly have aspects that are concerned with others. It is an integral aspect of this description of the ideal monk or the ideal nun, number 5, that he or she teaches the Dharma to others. It is also an integral aspect of this description that he or she, number 10, is moderate with requisites. This is a concern for the laity. The laity are offering these things. Don't take too much of them. Don't become a burden on them. Know what you really need and stop at that. And number 11, he or she should have metta or respect towards other monks or nuns, towards elders. At the same time, this whole set clearly puts the emphasis on personal development. See, the majority of qualities are about one's own practice. You should have insight into this and that, remove unwholesome states, have sense restraint, question others about the Dharma, etc. The gist of the practice, the main weight, not the gist, the main weight of the practice lies on oneself. And this, I think, is the very nicely reflects what, according to my understanding, is the basic position that early Buddhism takes in this respect. That it is important to work on oneself, and this should be given priority. But part of that path of self-development, naturally and inevitably, is concern for others. It naturally comes out of the practice, and it expresses itself. Somebody teaches more, somebody teaches less. Somebody is more respectful, somebody is a little bit less respectful. Individual varieties are there, but the basic openness towards others is always there. And I think this is a very important sketch we get of the ideal monk or nun in early Buddhism. And if you are interested in this in more detail, then you are welcome to take that PDF from the Ola page. You can copy it, pass it around. There's no copyright restriction on that. So before I get into Madhyama Agama 27, oh yeah, I'm happy a few students have said that they are not getting tired of this stupid stories I tell. So I feel that this is quite okay from time to time, my little silly stories. Bruni Alessandra, which is the right point of starting and teaching or eventually speaking about Dharma to others? Is there a point to do that? The thing is, a way to do that. I think there's a beautiful simile in Majjhima Nikaya 9 or 8, Salika Sutta. 8. Wrong citation. Majjhima Nikaya 8, Salika Sutta. One who is himself or herself sinking in the mud cannot pull out another. Only when you stand on firm ground are you able to pull out others out of the mud. So this doesn't mean to that you have to wait until you become an arahant, but it means that, as I also try to show with this listing, first of all, priority has to be given to your own development. You have to really grow, and it is only when you are firmly established in something that you will be able to convincingly teach that quality or that aspect of the Dharma to others. You see, I only get my own permission to sit here in front of you with this camera and all this because I did all my years up in that cave in Thailand and also in Sri Lanka doing a lot of practice. And I still sometimes feel, I don't know, shouldn't I just to practice only? But so there's a need to establish yourself at least one foot on firm ground before starting to pull out others. There's a problem in this tendency to emphasize compassion as the outstanding quality a Buddhist should have in some Buddhist traditions, as it is a very beautiful quality, but it needs to be established on a firm foundation, otherwise it just turns in circles. It becomes a samsara kind of thing. So the question is not for us to, exaggerating now, go to the next hospital and help all the sick people, which may at some point be an option, but the question is really, as these 11 qualities show, give priority to your own practice. And within that dynamic of your own practice, what naturally, without you being on the lookout for it, what naturally manifests, and from your inner feeling of where you stand and what you're able to give, feels appropriate, to that extent you share with others. So you have that basic openness towards that, but you're not eager for it, and you make sure you have at least one foot firmly on the ground. Well, this is my personal take on this, but I find that simile of not trying to pull out others from the mud if you're sinking yourself, because then both of you will just be sinking all the more. That simile is quite telling. Mark, we can help by encouraging each other in practice, even if you're not fully awakened. Oh, definitely. Yeah, there's no question. Helping, encouraging each other is no question. I think Alessandra was asking about teaching, about taking the role of a guide for others, and therewith also the responsibility that if I guide them wrongly, I am responsible for what happens. This is a issue that should be based on having at least one foot on firm ground. Yeah, metta, Alessandra says, metta. Mark says, if we cite the suttas in our encouragement, they are the guide. Yeah, that is you're again hitting a point that I am. This is central to what I do and to what I like to transmit also in my meditation teaching, in my writing, in this course, to enable us to approach the suttas as our teacher and to use these as our guide. That is a very safe and a very successful approach. I have tried it out myself. Li Chang, why it sounds a bit selfish to me if I only consider it in my practice and not spreading loving kindness through action. If you really concentrate on your practice, then that will naturally express itself in anything you do. But if you just the other extreme, just try to spread your loving kindness or compassion through action and neglect your practice, then there will be no real foundation and this will not have long-term effects. It is not selfishness if a person who sees that other people are sick does not immediately go there and try to help, but says, no, let me first go to the university and study medicine. And when I have done my 5 years of medicine and my 1 year of practice, I will come back to this place that I visited here and I'll be really able to help these people out of their illness. This is not selfishness, it is wisdom. Because if that person does not do his or her medical studies, he or she will not be able to really give the help the people need. There's a danger of becoming selfish about one's own practice, and in that respect I think you are definitely right. But the fact that priority is given to our own practice is in itself not necessarily selfishness. And it's good that you say that, because this is a very stereotype, common perception, because of this somewhat exaggerated emphasis on compassion in some Buddhist traditions. Stuart, I like the coward guiding the cows over the Ganges. Yeah, that's also a beautiful simile. Yeah, we are moving in our discussion precisely in the direction that I want to go with the next discourse, which is on which is the occasion I promised to many of you last year, that we will be discussing the actual practice of metta and of the Brahma Viharas. Maybe at this point I am not going to go into the discourse, because we only have a few more minutes, but I finish the point I want to make on compassion. Let me see. Wayne Cho has a practice out of compassion for people who have to put up with me. Venerable Sir, thank you so much for your lectures. I will listen to your lecture recording later. Connection keeps getting lost. Yeah, no problem. Yeah, maybe I just make my point on compassion, then I don't need to make that next lecture when we get into the Madhyama Agama 27, and then I can just speak about the actual meditation practice. You see, in early Buddhist thought, compassion is always an integral aspect of the four Brahma Viharas, the four divine abodes. So the first is metta. I prefer the Pali, the standard translation, loving kindness, or better would be benevolence. The second is compassion. The third is mudita, sympathetic or empathic joy. And the fourth is equanimity. And if you do a search in the Pali discourses, in the Chinese agamas, as I said before, this is a little bit more difficult to do, you will find that there are very few references to karuna or anukampa outside of this meditative context of the four Brahma Viharas. And those that you find are often related to the Buddha, like he should come or he should teach anukampa upadaya. But we find a lot of reference to metta outside of the practice of the four Brahma Viharas. And so the way I understand this is, you see, these metta is basically a feeling of friendship, mitra, a feeling of benevolence towards those who are without any kind of hierarchy, or those who are more or less at the same level. Karuna, compassion, is predominantly a feeling towards those who are in an unfortunate situation, and those who are in some way below me. They are suffering and I am looking down full of compassion. And mudita, sympathetic joy, is something more directed towards those who are better or superior to me. It's a kind of, if I visualize it, metta is on the level, compassion is downwards, and mudita is upwards. And all of these practices together is very meaningful. there's a lot of balance in there. And the basis of that is this metta practice. And this is why we get all these different discourses on how to practice metta, bodily speech, verbal, etc. But if we take compassion out of that context and do not base it on previous practice of metta and do not complement it with later practice of mudita, there's a problem there. Because we are practicing our attitude only in the downward manner, in the down-looking manner. And this is a natural consequence of the historical development of Buddhist thought, where the Buddha being fully awakened was naturally full of compassion. He was obviously superior to everyone else. So the idea of following in the Buddha's steps, which is also in the Theravada, but particularly prominent in the Mahayana tradition, made it naturally that this compassion quality became more prominent. And this feeling of wanting to be like the Buddha. But the problem is, if you're not an arahant yet, but only on the path towards becoming a Buddha or an arahant, whatever, and you give so much importance to compassion without practicing the other qualities, there is a slight danger that this might not be totally balanced, that this might come into developing a sense of ego to some extent. And we can see that, like this whole Hinayana rhetorics. Mahayana is just better than Hinayana, is precisely an expression of conceit. So I'm obviously not saying all who practice compassion are like this, all Mahayana, nothing of that type. I'm just saying that for me, a very important point to understand, from the perspective of what I understand from early Buddhism, compassion is best practiced, is an integral part of the Brahmaviharas, in order to avoid that it becomes a lopsided development. Yeah, Mark just adds that Avalokiteshvara is the one who looks down. That is precisely the idea. You look down. It's not the looking down which is disrespectful. You look down with compassion, but there is still this feeling of looking down. And if you balance that with, because you early practiced that looking level through metta, and after you do the looking upwards, mudita, others are better than me, there will be no problem. This safeguard is built in the Brahmavihara practice in early Buddhism. But once the compassion is taken out of that context, there can be that problem. Please don't misunderstand me. I'm not saying there must be that problem. I'm not saying it is wrong to have compassion. I'm just trying to give a perspective on compassion from my understanding of early Buddhism. And at this point, I am coming to the close of the lecture. I have learned a lot from you this time. I'm very grateful to all these intelligent and nice comments and questions here and on the blog. It's really wonderful, and I've been able to get rid of something that I personally think is quite important at the end of this lecture, and I really look forward to see what all of you have to say to that. And next time we're going to go for Madhyama Agama 27 and for how meditation on metta and the Brahmaviharas is practiced in early Buddhism. Thank you very much. Be well, and see you in another week's time.